Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1019, Baba Ramdev and Hindutva Fascism, Part 2. This is being recorded on August 7th of the year 2018. In this program, I'm going to conclude the reading of a long article from the New York Times Magazine from Sunday, July 29th of 2018. It is about Baba Ramdev, an iconic figure in India, a big supporter of Narendra Modi, and his Hindutva fascist BJP and RSS. And Baba Ramdev is also a very successful businessman. His Patanjali operation, Patanjali, has become a multi-billion-dollar enterprise marketing Ayurvedic foods and cleaning products, cosmetics and medicines, and twinning that with yoga practice. There are many similarities between the fascism of Narendra Modi, the RSS, and Baba Ramdev, and other forms of fascism. We are going to review that at the end of this reading. There also are some very significant links between Modi, the RSS, and Hindutva fascism and Baba Ramdev's operation, and things going on elsewhere in the New York Times Magazine article from which I have been reading. There is an open comparison between Baba Ramdev and Donald Trump. I have noted in past programs that some of Donald Trump's main business contacts in India are with members of Modi's BJP. Steve Bannon, among others, was a big fan of Narendra Modi and one of the prime supporters of the man I call Saint Bernard. Bernie Sanders is a Hawaii congresswoman and former deputy chair of the Republican Party named Tulsi Gabbard, who is quite simply a left-cover Hindutva fascist, heavily networked with Narendra Modi and the RSS, and she beyond that is a devotee of the Hare Krishna cult that we looked at great length in For the Record 991. And if it seems like a reach or unfair to characterize that cult as Hindutva fascist, just go back and listen to that. It is amazing. Listen to Tulsi Gabbard's remarkable encomium to Guru Prabhupada, the head and the founder of the Hare Krishna cult. The Hare Krishna cult, by the way, is often not viewed by religious Hindus as being truly Hindu, and yet the Hare Krishna cult itself sees itself as restoring Hinduism to its ancient Vedic roots, very much like Ramdev's operation. And indeed, there are similarities, as I have spoken about, between Ramdev's operation and the Hindutva fascism of the BJP and RSS and other fascist movements, and their invocation on the one hand of a mythical, idealized past, and also the demonization of an other, be it, quote, infidels by the fascist Muslim Brotherhood, or be it Jews by the Nazis, or immigrants by contemporary European fascist movements. There is always someone else, the other, those people, gypsies, Roma, whoever, and they are the ones to blame. We are pure, they are not. And if we could only go back to the good old days, you know, the good old days, I guess, before running water, electricity, indoor plumbing, and antibiotics, boy, weren't those good times. You know, if we could only go back to the good old days, well, then everything would be just wonderful. as I mentioned, in addition to what I think are instructive similarities between Hindutva fascism, the Hindutva fascism of Modi, the RSS, and the BJP, and of Ramdev, there are important political and geopolitical connections as well. Pierre Omidyar of eBay, who founded First Look Media and whose operation became the repository for the Edward Snowden documentation and whose Intercept is the primary journalistic vehicle of Citizen Greenwald. Pierre Omidyar helped to bankroll the rise of Narendra Modi, and the former director of Omidyar Network in India, Jayant Sinha, became Modi's finance minister and in turn was garlanding some convicted cow vigilantes who had murdered someone reported to be trafficking in beef, as we have looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 889. Omidyar also helped to bankroll and to affect the rise of the OUNB's successor organizations in Ukraine. And Omidyar is partnered in Ukraine with the National Endowment for Democracy and the Agency for International Development. Both of them are basically cat's paws or cutouts for elements of U.S. intelligence. And in India, one of the main vehicles for Jayant Sinha and the Omidyar network was the Landesa operation of Roy Prosterman. Both of those evolving, both Prosterman and Landesa, evolving from the Rural Development Institute, part of the Phoenix program in Vietnam. That was an assassination program. Arguably the best work on that was done by Doug Valentine, again, Valentine, about the Phoenix program. He's also done other works in which he expanded on his work in the Phoenix program. His most recent that I'm aware of is the CIA as organized crime. For some background on just what the Phoenix program was really all about. We are also going to talk about, at the conclusion of what we're dealing with here, the geopolitical aspects. I think it is very interesting that Omidyar has been assisting the rise of the OUNB successor fascists in Ukraine, and also the BJP RSS Hindutva fascists in India. If one looks at the Earth Island, or the World Island, that vast stretch of land stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, much of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, including Russia and China and India, it includes most of the world's landmass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources, and geopoliticians have long seen controlling the Earth Island as the key to global domination. I will discuss this at greater length in our next show. The basic, arguably the most basic military tactic or maneuver is what is known as a flanking operation. You move up on the enemy's flank rather than a frontal confrontation or assault. If one views the Earth Island in that context, both Ukraine and India could be seen as two elements of a flanking maneuver on the Earth Island, of Russia on the one hand and China on the other. And we are going to talk about that in our next program. Indeed, recently, James Mattis rechristened the American naval and theatrical operations, by that I mean theater of war, operations in the Pacific as Indo-Pacific. And indeed, the U.S. Navy is now engaging, working with the formerly neutral India, a nuclear power, in what is quite clearly anti-Chinese containment maneuvers. This at the same time as Donald Trump is engaging in a trade/tariff war with China. So the larger implications of Omidyar active in Ukraine, Omidyar active in India, and indeed the kickoff of the new Cold War with Russia was Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden's basically his, he travels first to Hong Kong when Barack Obama's meeting with President Xi of China, thereby complicating U.S. relations with China. Then just as Obama's meeting with Merkel and European leaders, information about NSA spying on Germany is released by Citizen Greenwald, for all practical purposes, a Nazi attorney. And then just before Barack Obama is going to meet with President Putin of Russia, Snowden travels from Hong Kong to Russia, courtesy of WikiLeaks, and that forces the cancellation of the summit, and the new Cold War was on. And I think Omidyar in Ukraine, Omidyar in India, and the rise of and the promotion of fascist elements in both countries, and the larger geostrategic implications of this loom very large here. Never lose sight of the fact, and for people who are do for fascism, what? I said, Dave, I mean, you're using them funny words there. Hindu for what? Hindu for what? Hindu fascism? Like, what is that all? Funny stuff. India, man, those people are funny over there. Kind of like Arabs, you know, with the funny words and funny clothes, and, you know, we don't care about that. It is very significant. India, again, the second most populous country on Earth, with roughly a sixth of the Earth's population. It is a nuclear power, and it could be seen as an element of a flanking maneuver on the Earth Island, along with Ukraine bordering on Russia. More about that later.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, back to the reading of the article which we were reading in our last program and which will serve as the platform for discussion in our next program as well. From the New York Times Magazine of July 29th of 2018, an article, Baba Ramdev's Holy War by Robert F. Worth. And it's about Baba Ramdev of the Patanjali Corporation. And we're going to leap right in where we left off last time in our last show. Many Indian Muslims say they have begun to feel like strangers in their own land. The BJP has proposed a number of laws with a troubling sectarian cast. One of them would allow immigrants from nearby countries who are Hindu, Buddhist, Sikh, or Christian to apply for citizenship, but would explicitly exclude Muslims. Even worse, some Muslims say, is the government's winking attitude toward communal violence. In 2015, a Hindu mob in the village near Delhi beat a Muslim to death on suspicion of having eaten beef. When one of the accused killers later died of an unrelated illness, a BJP politician attended his funeral. The coffin was draped in the Indian flag, and episodes like this have multiplied since Modi's victory in 2014. Ramdev's success at rebranding yoga and popular Hinduism may owe something to the inspirational power of his oft-told life story. Ramdev was born in a poor farm family. Ramdev was born to a poor farm family in north central India, probably in 1965. He has always been vague about his age, and he was given the name Ram Kisan Yadav, Y-A-D-A-V. As a child, he worked in the fields and suffered a series of illnesses and accidents. When I met him in Haridwar, he showed me a horizontal scar on his forehead, the legacy of a fall when he was 3 or 4. Later, he fell into the village pond and nearly drowned. After the illness that paralyzed the left side of his face, other children mocked him for his squint. He read about yoga in a book, he told me, and began practicing it in order to fortify his weak body. As a teenager, he left home for a Gurukul, then this next part is really important. The years that followed his departure for the Gurukul are curiously blank. Ramdev has said very little about them, sometimes claiming that he doesn't remember. What is clear is that in 1995 he became a monk and assumed his current name after a revelation he described to me like this, quote, "No personal choice, no personal desires, no wealth, no respect or disrespect. My whole skill, whole existence for all," unquote. Again, where was he and what was he doing in these missing years? And might those missing years have something to do with the venture capital that funded his now multi-billion dollar operation? Always in politics, follow the money. Where did the money to start up Patanjali come from? And where in bloody hell was Ramdev during these missing years? I don't believe it when he says he doesn't remember where he was. That dog won't hunt. Where was he during these missing years? What was he doing? Where did the money to finance Patanjali come from? Where did that venture capital come from? These are very, very important questions. Continuing, Ramdev started teaching yoga soon afterward. He also teamed up with Balkrishna, the CEO of Patanjali, whom he met at the Gurukul, and the two men began peddling their homemade herbal pills and unguents from a modest clinic that would eventually go into Patanjali. An early breakthrough came in 2002 when a religious TV channel called Astha, A-A-S-T-H-A, offered to broadcast Ramdev's yoga classes. He quickly became a star, charming audiences with his mobile eyebrows, his giggles, his trademark undulating stomach muscle routine, a traditional asana adapted for TV audiences. At the time, relatively few Indians practiced yoga, even as millions of Americans were doing sun salutations and intoning their namastes. It was considered an austere discipline linked to ancient texts, too complex and rigorous for ordinary people. Ramdev changed that. He is a lower caste Hindu who speaks in a playful, down-to-earth language. He simplified the breathing exercises and postures, making them accessible to anyone. Yet he also urged his listeners to be proud of yoga, calling it a quintessential expression of the wisdom contained in the sacred Hindu texts. Now here again, the forging of yoga into the theological fascist invocation of the bygone mythical idealized past, something that many forms of fascism had. As we will see, the Aryan mythology of the SS and Heinrich Himmler dovetails with aspects of this. And by the way, the same is true of the Hare Krishna cult. And Heinrich Himmler too saw yoga as a manifestation of the ancient Aryan culture, and we'll talk about that probably in this program. Continuing, repeating the last sentence again, he also urged his listeners to be proud of yoga, calling it a quintessential expression of the wisdom contained in the sacred Hindu texts. This narrative about yoga's ancient roots has become a sacrament for Hindu nationalists, and it is echoed in the West, but it is mostly myth, an idealized origin story of the kind so many would-be nation builders from ancient Rome to the Zionists have fostered about themselves. The oldest Hindu scriptures contain almost no mention of physical postures. Even the Yoga Sutras, the so-called Bible of Yoga, include only a few short verses suggesting comfortable postures for sitting. Many of the postures practiced in yoga today appear to have emerged in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Dozens of modern Ashtanga yoga postures are similar or identical to those found in a gymnastic routine introduced to India by the British in the first decades of the 20th century and originally developed by a Danish fitness instructor named Niels Buch, N-I-E-L-S, last name B-U-K-H, who later became notorious for his pro-Nazi sympathies. Buch, needless to say, has been conveniently forgotten by both Indians and the yoga-loving celebrities of Hollywood. But yoga is only half of Ramdev's work. He and Balkrishna also used their television empire to tout the healing virtues of Patanjali's Ayurvedic medicines and health foods, rooted in the supposedly curative powers of herbal and mineral compounds. Western scientists view Ayurveda, the science of life, with skepticism, and studies have found that some Ayurvedic products contain toxic levels of heavy metals, usually from soil or ash in the mix. But in India, they have become a booming business thanks in part to Ramdev's marketing efforts. Balkrishna gave me a tour of Patanjali's Medical Research Institute in a gleaming new building that was inaugurated last year by Modi himself. Swami Ramdev's herbs help you overcome all problems, the Prime Minister told the crowds gathered for the event. If Ramdev is Patanjali's flamboyant mascot, Balkrishna is his foil, a number-crunching introvert with buck teeth and a high, soft voice. He led me upstairs to a laboratory where white-coated technicians were drying masses of swampy green spirulina, a form of algae, to be packed into pills. Quote, "It is high in protein and vitamins," one of the men told me. In his spare time, Balkrishna said he wanders the forests of the Himalaya looking for medicinal herbs. Some can be found growing in the garden behind the research center, adjoining a Disney-style religious theme park with life-size sculpted figures enacting scenes from the Vedas inside man-made caves. It all looked like Hindu kitsch to me, but for Ramdev and Balkrishna, all this herbal wisdom is serious business. When it comes to marketing against foreign competitors, they wield their holiness like a club. One Patanjali ad runs, "As East India Company plundered our country for 200 years, likewise, these multinationals are exploiting our country by selling their harmful and dangerous chemical products. Beware," unquote. Ramdev's competitors have sued Patanjali repeatedly, but the slurs persist. The Swadeshi campaign of economic nationalism has served Ramdev very well. And again, the comparison between this and Mussolini's corporate state and Hitler's national socialism, I think, is important. Beginning again. The Swadeshi campaign has served Ramdev very well. Economic nationalism is not just an effective sales pitch. It has also allowed Ramdev to neatly sidestep attacks on his own business practices. Those attacks began as early as 2005, when a quarter of Patanjali's workers went on strike, claiming they'd been underpaid. Ramdev and Balkrishna promptly fired them, but some of the workers kept samples of the firm's medicines and said they contained unlisted ingredients, including crushed human skulls, presumably residue from soil or ash. A government lab test found human and animal DNA in the samples. In response, Ramdev accused, quote, powerful interests, unquote, of tampering with the samples. A later test of new samples found nothing amiss. His fans came to his defense, as did politicians in the BJP of Narendra Modi. Over the years, this way of fending off criticism has become a pattern. Nonetheless, Patanjali has faced at least half a dozen legal actions over its products. In October of 2016, the Food and Drug Administration of Haryana State found Patanjali's cow ghee, G-H-E-E, or clarified butter, to be, quote, substandard and unsafe, unquote. Last April, the Indian military stopped selling a popular Patanjali juice to soldiers after a government agency tested samples and found them, quote, unfit for consumption, unquote. Patanjali countered that the juice was medicine and thus the wrong test had been performed. In the banned biography of Ramdev published last year, the journalist Priyanka Pathak Narain wrote that Patanjali's cow ghee, advertised as the purest on the market, was made from white butter sourced from hundreds of thousands of small producers, blending cow, buffalo, and goat milk. In India, where pure ghee is required for religious purposes, such things matter. Some former employees say Ramdev is guilty of far more than safety violations. One former high-level executive at Patanjali who worked at the company for several years spoke to me on condition of anonymity, saying he feared retaliation. When I asked him why he left, he said of Ramdev, quote, because he's a crook, because he's a hypocrite, unquote. He rattled off a sheaf of shocking claims about fraud and employee abuse. These have been written about in the Indian press, but none appear to have been substantiated in court. One story involved Ramdev's brother, Ram Bharat, B-H-A-R-A-T, who was arrested in 2013 and accused of kidnapping and imprisoning a worker suspected of theft. The charges were later dropped. Another former Patanjali executive told me similar stories and added that he began receiving threatening phone calls after he refused to facilitate what he saw as kickback schemes. He complained to Balkrishna, he said, but the calls continued. Feeling his life might be in danger, he resigned. A Patanjali spokesman categorically denied that any of these events took place. Despite his popularity, Ramdev has long been trailed by even darker speculations centered on the deaths of two close associates. In 2007, Ramdev's own guru, a man named Shankar Dev, S-H-A-N-K-A-R, last name capital D-E-V, disappeared without a trace after falling into poverty and illness, and questions were raised about Ramdev's neglect of him. Because Dev initiated Ramdev into monkhood, Ramdev would have been expected to treat him like a parent. In 2010, Rajiv Dixit, D-I-X-I-T, one of Ramdev's closest advisors, who taught him about Swadeshi economics and helped Patanjali become a national brand, died suddenly. Some of his friends believe that Ramdev resented Dixit's own rising celebrity, and they publicly speculated about foul play. The cardiac arrest was cited as the cause of death, and Ramdev has dismissed efforts to implicate him as a conspiracy by his political enemies. When I asked him about this and other insinuations, he cast them all aside with a smile and a wave of his hand. It's not true, he told me. I am a very simple and humble and compassionate person, unquote. In other words, it's fake news from the lying news media. Sound familiar? By the way, I would note that the economic nationalism or Swadeshi of Baba Ramdev bears certain similarities to Donald Trump's tariff program as well. Again, not to be overlooked here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terrafractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing, from Ramdev's critics, the skeletons in his closet reply to a broader concern that his political value to the BJP may have placed him above the law. I heard wealthy business people in Delhi speak of him with audible fear in their voice, as if he could damage them at will. One thing is certain. Ramdev has received extraordinary favors from the Indian government since Modi was elected. Soon after the 2014 election, BJP-led state governments across India began facilitating steep discounts on land purchases for Patanjali. There is some precedent for nonprofits or religious organizations to receive such favors, but the deals Patanjali got were very unusual. In the largest of these deals, Patanjali was given a 1,200-acre parcel of land in the eastern state of Assam at no cost. According to state legislature documents I was shown by a local academic, the deal was made by an agency controlled by the Bodoland, BODOLAND People's Front, a party aligned with the BJP of Narendra Modi. Last year, a Reuters investigation documented several discounted land sales and leases in three other Indian states that saved the company a total of $46 million. Critics say these deals were partly payback for the boost Ramdev provided to the BJP in the elections. But by spreading Patanjali's presence into outlying areas where it needed support, the party was also sowing the seeds of future electoral victories. The state of Assam is about 2.5 hours east of Delhi by plane, a sprawling strip of lush jungle and floodplain squeezed between the mountain kingdom of Bhutan to the north and watery Bangladesh to the south. Urbane Indians speak of Assam as a frontier zone known for its wild rhinos and tigers, its indigenous, quote, tribal, unquote, populations, and its history of insurgencies. Distrust of the central government runs deep, thanks to a long history of neglect and exploitation of Assam's rich natural resources, rubber, silk, timber, tea, and crude oil. There is also widespread resentment of the Bangladeshi refugees, many of them Muslim, who have fled across the border in recent decades. For the BJP and its allies, Assam seemed fertile ground for Hindutva or Hindu ideology. Not long after the party's 2014 victory, Patanjali secured two large tracts in Assam and began work on a vast production facility. I reached the plant after a bumpy 8-hour journey through endless tea plantations and was greeted by the site manager, an ebullient man with bushy eyebrows named S. B. Singh. That's S as in Sam, B as in boy, Singh, S-I-N-G-H. Singh's newly built office was empty, apart from a large picture of Ramdev on the wall. Through the windows, we could see earth-moving machines and construction crews and big piles of muddy, ochre-hued soil. There was jungle where we're sitting, Singh told me. Elephants. Patanjali got the factory up and running in only 132 days, he told me, raising the jungle and clearing out a total of 88 elephants before building a complex of warehouses on the 155-acre site. The elephants were guided gently to a patch of forest nearby, Singh told me. He unleashed a blizzard of statistics. 4,000 workers, 1.2 million bags of cement, a 20-person management team, his eyes sparkling with pride at the achievement. The plant remained unfinished and was still running at partial capacity. But already hundreds of workers were busy making cookies and cosmetics. Thousands more were being trained, and not just in job skills. Quote, We are mentally conditioning them, Singh said. Patanjali ran more than 380 workshops for prospective employees, where it taught a, quote, value system, unquote. Assam's people, he explained, had bad habits, unquote, including eating non-vegetarian food and a lack of proper respect for the nation, quote. They've been listening to corrupt politics from corrupt people for too long, he said. We take what our sages told us thousands of years ago, and we put it to use. We didn't invent it. We took what's available in our scriptures and put it into a modern format, unquote. In other words, they inculcate Hindutva. Singh took me on a tour of the production complex in an electric golf cart. After admiring the cookie plant and its 300-foot oven, we drove across a deliciously smooth, median-free stretch of pavement that resembled a runway. In fact, it is a runway built in consultation with the Indian Air Force so that jet fighters can take off and land on it. Singh told me, we will dedicate this to the nation in case there is a need for an extra airstrip, unquote, he said, and then added with a knowing look, we are near China, unquote. Patanjali seems almost to view itself as an extension of the state, or rather, an illustration of what has become, quote, a state, temple, corporate complex, unquote, in the apt phrase of the Indian author Meera Nanda, M-W-E-R-A, lesson N-A-N-D-A. One more time, because I think this is critical. The sentence about what is going on after this paragraph. After admiring the cookie plant and its 300-foot oven, that's an awfully big oven. I wonder if cookies are going to be the only thing to get baked in that oven. Beginning again, after admiring the cookie plant and its 300-foot oven, we drove across a deliciously smooth, median-free stretch of pavement that resembled a runway. In fact, it is a runway built in consultation with the Indian Air Force so that jet fighters can take off and land on it, Singh told me. We will dedicate this to the nation in case there is need for an extra airstrip, unquote, he said, and then added with a knowing look, we are near China, unquote. Patanjali seems almost to view itself as an extension of the state, or rather, an illustration of what has become, quote, a state, temple, corporate complex, unquote, in the apt phrase of the Indian author Meera Nanda. Patanjali's work in Assam has benefited from the longer-term efforts of the RSS. Founded in 1925, the group was briefly banned several times in the wake of communal riots, most recently in 1992. It periodically went underground doing grassroots organizing and forming dozens of affiliate organizations that often hide their links with the RSS. Most of the BJP's top leaders, including Narendra Modi himself, emerged from the RSS and profess loyalty to it. Yet, for all its vast influence, there is something curiously slippery about the RSS. Its ideologues insist that it is larger than Hinduism or any single religion, and they speak of a mystical connection with the Indian subcontinent and the saffron flag, the group's symbol. They aspire to change India at both the collective and the individual level. It is a man-making mission, I was told by Shiv Shakti Bakshi, an RSS veteran who now runs the BJP's English language publications. To make a man who can work for the society a selfless worker for the society, unquote. This focus on personal change meshes perfectly with Ram Dev's promotion of physical fitness and health, and Bakshi spoke about the guru in glowing terms. His messages are taken seriously by people. He said, in elections, opinion building is important, unquote. The RSS has become more visible since Modi's 2014 victory. The group and its affiliates have built hundreds of schools and job training centers in Assam and other northeastern states in recent years. I visited several and saw unmistakable signs of the RSS ideological program. At one school, young children, some of whom had been raised Christian, recited Hindu prayers and sang songs to Lord Ram before starting their lessons, which include Sanskrit instruction. All this hard indoctrination work has paid off. In 2016, the BJP won control of Assam's state governments in legislative elections, and in March of this year, the party won stunning electoral upsets in two adjacent northeastern states where leftist parties had dominated for decades. There was talk of a saffron wave, unquote, that might spread to the South Indian regions, including communist-dominated Kerala, that have long resisted the advance of Hindu nationalism. Many political analysts said the RSS's grassroots work was essential to the recent electoral victories. That last sentence again. Many Indian political analysts said the RSS's grassroots work was essential to the recent electoral victories. But one RSS volunteer in Assam, a construction contractor, told me Ramdev's presence and his yoga promotion had been very influential as well. The contractor said he'd helped to arrange the purchase of cement and other supplies for the new Assam factory site I toured. But eventually, he soured on Patanjali, which he saw as too focused on the bottom line. Quote, "Even we are not happy with the way the government helps Ramdev so much," the contractor told me. "The latest wave of BJP victories has been attended by angry criticism of the way the party feeds communal resentments, and Ramdev has not been spared from them." Assam's BJP-led state government is compiling a citizenship registry that could cause millions of residents, mostly Muslims, to be declared stateless and expelled in an eerie echo of the disenfranchisement that preceded the mass murder of Rohingya people in nearby Myanmar. One Assamese university professor, who asked not to be named because he feared for his safety, told me that Ramdev had abetted the RSS's efforts to, quote, "question all other religions here, anything non-Hindu," unquote. He also said Patanjali, emboldened by its ties to the Modi government, had run roughshod over laws regulating the harvest of medicinal plants. The same qualities that have fueled Patanjali's meteoric rise, its evangelistic fervor, its dependence on Ramdev's popularity and political connections, have also made it vulnerable. A surprising number of employees told me they saw the company as a high-wire act that might not last. "Conceptually, it's still not an organization," Singh, the manager of the new plant in Assam, told me. "It's an ashram on a large scale. And what happens on an ashram, what the guru says, you do," unquote. Patanjali's sales have grown with extraordinary speed, and Singh told me it worried him. "When you stretch something, a vacuum opens up in the middle," he said, pulling his hands apart as if tearing a lump of pizza dough. In Haridwar, one young employee named Prashad told me he'd been so impressed by Ramdev that he left his corporate job and took a huge pay cut to join Patanjali. But now he worried about the company's future. "I don't see it, how they'd continue paying low salaries and maintain quality," he said. He added that he would leave the company when he married and needed more income. Retention has been a persistent problem for Ramdev. Applicants flock to the company despite the fact that Patanjali reportedly pays 25 to 50% less than its competitors. Many leave after a year or less. I was told by executives at Papa Jolly and other companies. Quote, autonomy is very low, said one executive at a competing company who asked not to be named, saying, like many other people I spoke to, that he feared retaliation if he spoke on the record. Quote, Rondev is very hands-on. There is no doubt who's in charge. He is a micromanager, unquote. Behind his laughing public persona, Rondev is said by some to be an autocratic boss capable of lashing out furiously when he is thwarted. I got a glimpse of Rondev's ashram-style management at Haridwar, where he allowed me to observe him one afternoon. On the second floor of the company's main corporate office, the hallway was clogged with followers who had come for a glimpse of the guru. One group told me they had come all the way from Tamil Nadu in the far south. Eventually, one of Rondev's handlers escorted me past the guards and into a wood-paneled office, and there was Rondev, a splash of saffron color among button-down Oxford shirts and gray flannel pants. He was sitting languidly on a couch, a wooden sandal dangling from his toe, interviewing candidates for jobs in sales and marketing. The applicants seemed as much in awe of Rondev as the followers outside. As they entered, each of them touched Rondev's feet reverently, then sat down. He asked them to say what they would contribute to Patanjali. A senior executive sat nearby taking notes, but Rondev presided over the interview like a king on a throne. He is involved in even the smallest details, decisions about hiring, ads, and product development. If anything were to puncture his aura some scandal worse than those he has weathered in the past, it is hard to imagine that Patanjali would last more than a day. Rondev would not be the first godman to crash and burn. At least a half dozen other powerful gurus have been arrested and charged with serious crimes in the past 20 years. The most recent, and perhaps the most flamboyant, was Gurmeet Ram Rahim Singh, a pot-bellied and chubby-cheeked figure who cast himself as a superhero in several bizarre, self-made action movies with titles like MSG, Messenger of God. Singh, who claimed 60 million followers around the world, was convicted of rape last August and sentenced to 20 years in prison. He has also been formally accused of castrating about 400 of his disciples, a charge he denies. After the verdict was issued, his followers rioted, smashing cars, setting fire to buildings, and attacking police officers. At least 38 people were killed, and more than 250 injured. But Rondev is bigger and better protected than his predecessors. Patanjali has vastly expanded the market for Ayurvedic products, and in late 2014, Modi created an entire new government ministry to promote yoga and Ayurveda, elevating what had been an obscure government office. Rondev has made himself a symbol of Indian economic independence, and no one wants to question that, not even his enemies. One Indian CEO who has accused Patanjali of false advertising told me he was grateful to Rondev, despite his many sins, for attracting a new customer base in ways that benefited everyone. The worst thing for us would be if he implodes. With Godman, you never know, he said. That would impact the whole Ayurvedic market, unquote. Rondev appears to have a second layer of insurance. The clouds that hang over him also hang over his political patrons. Modi is regarded by much of the secular elite as a criminal because of his supposed role in the 2002 Gujarat riots. His close ally Amit Shah, the leader of the BJP, and by most accounts the second most powerful man in India, was arrested in 2010 and charged with arranging the murder of an underworld couple in police custody and making it look as if they were killed during a shootout. The case was ultimately dropped, but suspicions about Shah's role linger, fueled by a recent series of investigative stories in the Indian press. Modi and Shah respond to their accusers in exactly the same way Ramdev does, by lambasting the secular elite. Their shared feelings of unjust persecution appear to thicken their bond with Ramdev, and they see no need to change their stance. By all available measures, the Indian public is as supportive of Ramdev as ever. In early May, a widely watched business survey reported that Patanjali was the most trusted brand in the country, beating about 1,000 other companies in its sector, including multinationals. If the Modi government gets its way, Ramdev's star will rise even higher. At the Chhatrasal Stadium event in February, Amit Shah told the crowd that the BJP wanted Ramdev to join them in reforming the Indian educational system. One of the party's new priorities is an ambitious effort to rewrite Indian school textbooks to assert Hindu primacy. Mahesh Sharma, India's culture minister and an avowed follower of the RSS, has said he hopes to rewrite the conventional narrative about India as a multicultural tapestry and to inculcate the belief that the ancient Hindu scriptures are historical facts, not legends. "There is a lot of work to be done in education," Shah said on the stadium floor, just after the premiere of Ramdev's biopic. "Because of our saints and our heroes, all this needs to be brought into our educational system," unquote. When his turn came to speak, Ramdev walked to the lectern, smiling graciously at the gaggle of BJP luminaries on stage. He pledged his support to Modi and Shah and their efforts to transform India. "If the first 50 years of my life were a struggle," he said, "my next 50 years, I dedicate my time and energy to the cultural and spiritual education of the country to bring our country the great knowledge of the Vedas," he went on. "We will see an Indian education policy in this country instead of the education policy given us by Lord Macaulay." Before stepping down, he pumped his fist once again in a chant of, "India, my motherland, is great." The crowd roared. By the way, Narendra Modi, when he spoke at the SAP Center right here in San Jose in Silicon Valley, led the crowd in a similar chant. I believe it was the same chant. I'm going to include in our next broadcast an audio track of that. There is a lot to talk about. Note the similarities in certain respects between the Swadeshi or economic nationalism of Ramdev and Donald Trump's tariffs and talking of how, you know, foreign countries are taking advantage of us and we're going to do something about it. Not exact, but I think similar and a valid comparison. Also, note the xenophobia, the BJP and Ramdev supported drive to disenfranchise, quote, outsiders, unquote. A lot of headlines here in the U.S. are being taken up by Donald Trump and his anti-immigrant fervor as well, something that is happening all over the world. Again, for the record, 1013, about fascism and the politics of immigration, goes into that. We also are going to talk about how yoga and its more varied, recent, and diverse origins than Hindu nationalists and yoga traditionalists, they're going to term portray it, was adopted by the Nazi SS as not only a practical vehicle for fitness and relaxation. And again, I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing yoga as Nazi. People I greatly respect practice yoga, and I've never seen anything impugning the physical fitness and psychological relaxation benefits of yoga. But both Ramdev and Patanjali and Heinrich Himmler and the SS saw yoga as a manifestation of the ancient Aryan past, and the SS were seen by Himmler as the reincarnation of the Kshatriya warrior caste. By the way, something that Guru Prabhupada of the Hare Krishna sect also endorsed. And again, the incorporation of yoga into a Hindutva manifestation of the idealized, quote, Aryan, unquote, mythical past of India by both Ramdev and also Heinrich Himmler and the SS, I think, are similar. And we will be talking about that more in our last program. In our next program, excuse me. Again, in the article we just read, Baba Ramdev's Holy War by Robert F. Worth, it talks about this. The narrative about yoga's ancient roots has become a sacrament for Hindu nationalists, and it is echoed in the West, but it is mostly myth, an idealized origin story of the kind so many would-be nation builders have fostered about themselves. The oldest Hindu scriptures contain almost no mention of physical postures. Even the Yoga Sutras, the so-called Bible of Yoga, include only a few short verses suggesting comfortable postures for sitting. Many of the postures practiced in yoga today appear to have emerged in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Dozens of modern Ashtanga yoga postures are similar or identical to those found in a gymnastic routine introduced to India by the British in the first decades of the 20th century and originally developed by a Danish fitness instructor named Niels Buch, who later became notorious for his pro-Nazi sympathies. We'll develop this more in our next program. Also note that Hindutva fascism or Hindu nationalism, as manifested by BJP, by RSS, and as furthered by Ramdev and his ventures in Assam, supported by the Modi government, are also making inroads into areas of India that had traditionally had governance by various communist or socialist parties. So the Hindutva fascism also is manifesting in an anti-communist capacity as well, the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of fascism and its corporatist economic program have long endeared it to a powerful corporate and financial interests. However, we will talk more about that in our next program. This concludes For the Record Program 1019, Baba Ramdev and Hindutva Fascism. This is being recorded on August 7th of the year 2018. My name is Dave Emery. Have fun.